All right, welcome back for another deep dive. This time, we're taking a look at a lecture transcript. It's called Foundations of Biblical Prophecy, Lecture 10 by Robert Vinoy. And he had some interesting stuff to say about prophets in ancient Israel, specifically like their relationship to the rituals of worship, you know, what scholars sometimes call the cult.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic for sure. A lot of people think, you know, prophets were totally against rituals, but Vinoy pushes back on that idea pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've kind of always thought of prophets as like anti-ritual, more about, you know, a direct connection with God, not so much about ceremonies and stuff.
Sure, that's a pretty common perception, but Vinoy brings up some interesting examples. He points to guys like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and actually they talk about the importance of the temple and sacrifices and stuff.
Really? Huh, that's kind of surprising. So maybe it's not such a black and white issue then.
Exactly. Vinoy's point is that true religion, at least in the Old Testament, it involved both a relationship with God and these specific ways of expressing that relationship. And those ways, a lot of times, were rituals. I mean, think about it. Could you even imagine a religion with no rituals or practices?
That's a good question. Yeah. No, I guess you're right. Even outside of religion, people have rituals. Like, think about, like, your morning coffee routine or how you get ready for bed. I mean, maybe rituals are just part of how we as humans, like, connect with something bigger than ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if you look at the Old Testament, especially those first five books, the Pentateuch, you see tons of rituals. They're all over the place. They're part of the fabric of the faith.
Okay, so rituals were definitely a thing in ancient Israel. But if prophets weren't completely against them, like, where do we get that image of, you know, the fiery prophet condemning empty rituals? Where does that come from?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. See, Vinoy isn't saying prophets were, like, pro-ritual, not in some uncritical way. He says they were against what he calls opus operatum.
Opus operatum. Okay, for those of us who don't speak Latin, what does that mean?
Basically, it means by the work, it is worked. So, like, saying the ritual is effective just because you did it, it doesn't matter about your heart or intentions or anything. Just going through the motions, a mechanical kind of religion.
So like just showing up and doing the motions, that's not enough.
Nope. He uses this example of Hosea and the Israelites. They were worshiping Baal, even doing things like temple prostitution.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah, that's
right. But they thought they could just like bring sacrifices to Yahweh and it'd all be good, like cover their sins with a ritual.
Trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Pretty much. And Hosea calls them out. Hard. He's saying God wants heresy, not just sacrifices, right? Empty sacrifices.
Yeah, it's about changing your heart, not just doing the motions, right?
Exactly. And you see the same thing again and again. Like Amos, he gets right to the point. There's this one part where he's like, did you even bring me sacrifices for those 40 years in the wilderness? And it's always been kind of a puzzle, this passage.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that one. What's going on there?
Well, there's a couple ways to understand it. One scholar, McComiskey, he says Israel was actually being disobedient back then in the wilderness. They totally neglected the sacrifices. They were turning to idolatry.
So they weren't even doing the rituals in the first place.
Right. But then you've got another scholar, Ritterbos, who says maybe they did offer sacrifices, but, you know, they were wandering in the desert. The full system wasn't really in place because... Well, it was tough.
Okay, so two pretty different interpretations. But even with those different views, do they, like, agree on anything?
Oh, totally. Both interpretations say, in the end, the ritual alone, that's not enough. It's about obedience. It's about your heart being right with God, not just checking off some box.
Okay, so that's Amos. But then there's Jeremiah, chapter 7, verse 22. It sounds like God's saying he didn't command any sacrifices after the Exodus. How do you even make sense of that?
Yeah, that one's a head-scratcher. It's puzzled people for a long time. One scholar, Rawls, he thinks it's going back to that very first covenant in Exodus 19. Remember, that was all about loyalty and obedience before any rituals were even mentioned.
So it's like God was saying, first, let's get the basics of our relationship straight. Then we can talk about how you show your devotion.
Exactly. But then you've got another scholar, Alice, and he says, well, that Hebrew word for concerning, it can also mean for the sake of. So maybe God isn't saying he didn't command sacrifices, but that he didn't do it because he needed them, you know?
So it wasn't like God was up in heaven like, I'm hungry for burnt offerings.
No, not at all. And Vinoy actually points to verse 21 where God basically says, just eat the burnt offerings yourselves. I don't want them. Like, he doesn't need sacrifices from a begrudging heart.
Wow. That's pretty powerful imagery. It makes you think about, like, why are we doing the things we do? Out of obligation,
right?
Or because we really want to.
Exactly. And that leads perfectly into Vinoy's big conclusion about prophets and the cult.
Okay, what's the takeaway here?
He says the prophets weren't anti-ritual, really, but they wanted this covenantal unity, inner devotion, and outward expression.
So bringing your whole self to the table, so to speak. Not just doing the motions, but really meaning it.
Exactly. And here's where it gets even more interesting. He argues that prophets weren't just delivering messages. They were actually part of the rituals they were critiquing.
Wait, hold on. How does that work? How can you be critical of something and also participate in it?
It's pretty fascinating, right? To understand what he's saying, we got to look at a couple of other scholars, Aubrey Johnson and Sigmund Mowinkel. They both argued that prophets were basically what you'd call cultic functionaries.
Okay, so what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means they weren't just like commentators on the sidelines. They were actually active participants in the whole religious system. Johnson, for example, he really emphasizes the prophet's role in intercession and prayer. He even suggests that prophets in Jerusalem, like, they might have actually been part of the temple personnel.
Wow, that's a pretty big claim. Does he have anything to back that up?
He points to some passages where you see prophets and priests mentioned together, almost like they're, you know, working side by side. Like in Isaiah 28.7, it says, priests and prophets stagger from beer and are befuddled with wine.
Sounds like somebody was having a good time.
Yeah, right. But the point is they're mentioned together, so, you know, implies some kind of connection. And there are similar references, like in Jeremiah 4.9 and also in that story of Elijah when he's confronting the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. Plus, you know, a lot of times prophets, like Jeremiah, they're depicted delivering their messages right in the temple.
Okay, so there are some hints there, but is that enough to say they were officially part of the system?
Well, not everybody agrees with Johnson. Scholars like Jay Mocher and E.J. Young, while they acknowledge there's a connection there, they don't go so far as to call them cultic functionaries. They say the scriptural support just isn't really there.
Okay, so where does that leave us? If prophets weren't totally anti-ritual, but maybe not official priests either, what were they?
Well, Vinoy, he offers kind of a third way to look at it, a third perspective. He says, at their core, prophets were proclaimers of divine revelation.
Meaning?
Their main role was to, like, communicate God's message to the people. It didn't matter really what their specific position was or how they related to, you know, the religious institutions. God could call anybody to be a prophet, right? A priest like Ezekiel or a farmer like Elisha and Amos.
So it's about the message, not the messenger.
Exactly. And Vinoy argues that this perspective actually helps us understand those seemingly contradictory aspects of how prophets related to the cult. They weren't opposed to rituals necessarily, but they were willing to criticize them if they became empty or, you know, distorted. They weren't priests, but they were comfortable working within the system to get God's word out.
It's like they were walking this tightrope, you know, trying to uphold the true spirit of faith while also pushing back against the hypocrisy.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Challengers and participants, all at the same time.
So if the prophets were writers as well as speakers?
Ah, yes, the question of authorship. It's a question that has sparked so many debates among biblical scholars.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So the traditional view, the one that's been held for centuries, it's that the prophets actually were writers. They wrote down their messages either directly or, you know, maybe dictating to a scribe so those words could be preserved. And we even see hints of this process in the Bible itself.
Oh, I bet you have some examples.
Well, of course, like look at Jeremiah 36.1-28. It's a really interesting story. It describes how Jeremiah dictates his prophecies to Baruch, his scribe. And this scroll is then taken to the king. And guess what? The king burns it in a fit of rage.
Wow. Talk about rejecting the message.
Right. But then what happens next is even more interesting. God tells Jeremiah to rewrite the scroll. He makes sure those words aren't lost.
You can't stop the word of God. Any other example?
Yeah, we also see these hints of prophetic writing in Isaiah 30.8. God tells Isaiah to write down his words on a scroll so that for days to come, it may be an everlasting witness.
So like God saying, make sure you write this down, people. This is important.
Exactly. And these passages give us valuable insight into how prophetic messages were, preserved, even though the exact method probably varied from prophet to prophet.
But I have a feeling it's not quite that simple, is it? Things rarely are when it comes to biblical interpretation.
You're right. You're catching on. The literary critical school of thought, they make things a bit more complicated. They acknowledge that prophets were writers, but they focused on separating what they saw as like the wheat from the chaff.
What do you mean by that?
They were trying to figure out which words were the prophet's original words and what was added later by, you know, editors or scribes. They wanted to find the authentic stuff.
It's like being a biblical detective. But wasn't that approach kind of, you know, open to interpretation? A bit subjective?
Yeah, for sure. The literary critical approach, it opened up all these debates, different opinions. Like a prime example is the book of Isaiah.
Ah, Isaiah. prophet of doom and hope.
Exactly. Most critical scholars would agree that chapters 139 were probably written by Isaiah himself. But then you get to chapters 40, 66, and there's tons of debate about those. A lot of scholars think those chapters were written by somebody else. They call him Deutero-Isaiah, or sometimes Second Isaiah.
Wait, so they're saying Isaiah didn't write all of Isaiah?
That's what a lot of scholars argue, yeah. They point to some pretty big differences between the two sections.
Such as?
Well, they say the concepts and ideas in chapters 40, 66, they're very different from the earlier chapters. Like, the concept of Yahweh's servant, that plays a big role in the later chapters, but it's almost completely missing from the first part.
So it's like a shift in the theology.
Yeah, exactly. And there's more. They also point to differences in the language and the style, like vocabulary, sentence structure, literary techniques, all that stuff, and they say that means different authors.
Getting pretty technical. But, I mean, isn't it possible for a prophet's language and ideas to change over time? People change, right?
Right. That's a valid point. And some scholars who defend the unity of Isaiah, they bring that up. But the proponents of this Deutero-Isaiah theory, they have another argument. Historical context.
Okay, so what's the historical context argument?
Well, chapters 40, 66, they describe the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Those things happen after Isaiah's lifetime. And they also talk about the Babylonian exile and the rise of Cyrus, that Persian king who let the Jews go back home. These events, they argue, just don't fit with when Isaiah was around.
So, like, it's a prophecy from the future.
That's what it would be if Isaiah wrote the whole thing. But a lot of critical scholars, they don't buy that. They say it's much more likely those later chapters were written by an anonymous prophet, somebody who lived during the exile or maybe right after.
Sounds like we've got a biblical mystery on our hands.
We do. It's a mystery that's fueled tons of scholarly debate. The whole question of authorship, especially in Isaiah, it's a really complex puzzle.
Okay, so we've got these competing views on Isaiah, but what about Daniel? That one's always been kind of mysterious and intriguing.
You're right. Daniel's another one that literary critics have looked at really closely. And just like Isaiah, there are those who say the book, as we have it now, it's not from a single author writing in the 6th century BC. They say it was compiled over centuries.
So they're saying Daniel is like a Frankenstein monster stitched together from different parts.
That's a colorful way to put it. But to understand why they think that, we have to look at some of the challenges they bring up about, you know, who wrote Daniel.
Let's do it.
One of their main arguments is that the book has all this detailed knowledge of things that happened long after the 6th century BC, like especially the reign of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes in the 2nd century.
Hold on. They're saying Daniel predicted things that happened hundreds of years later.
That's what they say. They point to these really detailed descriptions of like how Antiochus persecuted the Jews, how he desecrated the temple, even how he died. And they say there's no way Daniel, writing in the 6th century, could have known all that.
Yeah, I could see why that would be hard to believe. It's like having a time traveler sending us messages.
Exactly. And that's not all. They also point to the book's use of Greek words and ideas. They say that points to a later date, closer to the Hellenistic period, when Greek influence was like everywhere.
So it's a language argument, too.
Exactly. They analyze the language, the historical details, even the structure of the book, trying to find clues that support a later date.
Okay, so who do they think did write it then? Do they have any other theories?
They do. A lot of them say Daniel was written during the Maccabean period. That was a time of intense Jewish resistance to, the Seleucid rule in the 2nd century BC. They say the book was meant to encourage the Jewish people, you know, in their struggle for religious freedom.
So instead of predicting the future, Daniel was actually reflecting on the past, using those historical figures and events to send a message to his own people.
That's exactly what they argue. They see Daniel as a work of historical fiction. It's like skillfully crafted to give people hope, especially when they were facing persecution.
Wow. It's amazing how different the interpretation can be depending on your perspective. It's like looking at the same painting, but seeing totally different things.
That's a good way to put it. It really shows you the challenges and the complexities of biblical interpretation.
Okay, so we've got these competing views on Isaiah and Daniel. But where does Vinoy stand on all this? Does he agree with the traditional view or the literary critics?
Well, Vinoy, as you might expect, he approaches the whole authorship question very carefully. He acknowledges what both sides are saying, the good points and the bad points.
So he's not jumping to conclusions?
No, not at all. He really digs into the evidence, the language, the historical context, the theological implications, and he ends up presenting a perspective that tries to bridge the gap between the traditional view and those more critical interpretations.
Okay, I'm all ears. What's Vinoy's take?
Well, he starts by talking about those arguments for Deutero-Isaiah in the book of Isaiah. He says, yeah, there are differences in style and emphasis between the two parts of the book, but he doesn't think that automatically means a different author.
Okay, so how does he explain those differences?
He points out that Isaiah had a long ministry over many decades, and it makes sense that his message and his style would evolve over time, you know, influenced by what was happening in the world and by new revelations from God.
So it's like saying a prophet isn't stuck in time. They grow and develop just like anybody else.
Right, exactly. Vinoy emphasizes that that revelation unfolds progressively. God doesn't reveal everything all at once. It's a process, a journey of understanding.
That makes sense. It's like God is having this ongoing conversation with us, revealing more of himself and his plans, little by little.
Exactly. And Vinoy suggests that the differences between the two sections of Isaiah, they're part of that unfolding revelation, like those later chapters with their emphasis on comfort and restoration and the coming of the servant, they might reflect like a deeper understanding that Isaiah came to later in his life.
So not two different authors, but one prophet who was growing in his understanding.
That's Vinoy's view. He pushes back on this idea that any difference in style or emphasis automatically means different authors. He says we have to remember that prophets were complex individuals. They lived through some crazy times. Their messages were shaped by their experiences, their struggles, and their relationship with God.
It makes you wonder if some of those arguments for Deutero-Isaiah, they're more about trying to fit the prophet into a neat little box, you know, instead of allowing for like the messiness of real life and spiritual growth.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it leads right into Vinoy's discussion of Daniel.
Okay, let's hear it. What does he say about Daniel?
Well, just like with Isaiah, Vinoy is really balanced. He looks at what the critics are saying, those who favor a later date, and he acknowledges the challenges.
So he's not just dismissing them?
Nope. He takes their concerns seriously. He looks at the evidence. But in the end, he concludes that there are good reasons to stick with the traditional view that Daniel was a 6th century prophet.
Okay, so what are those reasons? What makes him believe that?
Well, one of the main things is where the book is placed in the Hebrew Bible.
What do you mean?
Well, in the Hebrew Bible, Daniel isn't with the other prophets. It's grouped with the writings, you know, books like Psalms, Proverbs, Job, all that.
Huh. So it's in a different category than Isaiah or Jeremiah?
Right. And Vinoy says this placement suggests that people accepted Daniel as a genuine prophetic book pretty early on. If it had been written like during the Maccabean period, there's no way it would have been included in the canon that fast.
So it's about the historical context.
Yeah. And then there's the language. Daniel is written in the mix of Hebrew and Aramaic. And the Aramaic sections, they sound like the language of the Babylonian court in the 6th century BC.
So the language itself supports an earlier date.
Exactly. If it had been written later, during the Maccabean period, they probably would have just used Hebrew. That was the main language for Jewish literature back then.
It's like a linguistic fingerprint.
That's a great way to put it. And Vinoy also points out that the book has this like really deep theological unity. The themes of God's sovereignty, his faithfulness, his ultimate victory, all that. Those ideas fit with what the earlier prophets were saying.
It's all part of the same tapestry.
Right. Vinoy sees Daniel as a continuation of that prophetic tradition, building on what came before.
So it sounds like he makes a pretty strong case for the traditional view. But what about those detailed predictions of the future? That's the part that really trips people up, right?
Yeah, that's definitely part that critics focus on. They say there's no way Daniel could have known all that stuff centuries in advance.
So what does Vinoy say about that?
He admits it's a tough one, reconciling those predictions with a 6th century author. But he reminds us that the Bible is full of prophecy, God revealing his plans ahead of time.
So prophecy is just part of how the Bible works.
Right. He says if you deny the possibility of prophecy, you're basically undermining a core part of the Bible's message.
Okay, I can see his point. But even if we say prophecy is possible, how do we explain the level of detail in Daniel's visions? It's not just general stuff. It's specific names, dates, events.
Yeah, that's where it gets tricky. And Vinoy doesn't try to oversimplify things. He offers a few different explanations, each with its own, you know, strengths and weaknesses.
Okay, lay them on me.
Well, one possibility is that Daniel's visions, even though they were given in the 6th century, they were written down or edited later, maybe during the Maccabean period. So that would allow for those specific historical details.
So, like, the visions themselves were real, but the way they were recorded got updated.
Right. It's a way of acknowledging both the prophetic nature of the visions and the historical challenges.
Okay, that's one possibility. What else?
Another idea is that those visions operate on different levels of meaning. Like they might have had a primary fulfillment in Daniel's time, addressing the issues those Jewish exiles were facing in Babylon. But then they could also have a secondary fulfillment or even a third fulfillment in later times, like the Maccabean era.
So they're like an onion, layers of meaning.
That's a good way to think about it. And it's an approach that's been used to interpret a lot of biblical prophecies, especially the ones that seem to have multiple fulfillments.
Okay, got it. Any other explanations?
Well, a third possibility, and this one might be the hardest to wrap our minds around, is that Daniel's visions really were given by God, who's outside of time and space. He knows everything, past, present, future.
So it's about accepting the mystery of God's foreknowledge.
Exactly. It's acknowledging the supernatural element of prophecy, recognizing that God's ways aren't always our ways.
It definitely takes a certain amount of faith.
It does, and Vannoy admits that. He doesn't claim to have all the answers about Daniel's prophecies. He just offers these possibilities for us to think about, to wrestle with the mysteries of faith, to understand God's ways in the world a little better.
I really appreciate that he doesn't try to, like, force-fit everything into a neat little explanation. He's honest about the mystery.
Me too. He reminds us that faith isn't about having all the answers. It's about trusting God, even when things are confusing.
So what does all this tell us about prophets and the cult? What are the big takeaways from Vannoy's lecture?
I think the biggest one is that the relationship between prophets and the cult was much more complex than we often think. They weren't simply anti-ritual. They cared deeply about the authenticity of worship, making sure outward actions match inward devotion.
It's about having a heart that matches the motions.
Exactly. And then when he talks about the authorship debates about Isaiah and Daniel, it reminds us that biblical interpretation is an ongoing process. We're always wrestling with these tough questions, always trying to understand better.
And it's okay to not have all the answers. It's about asking the tough questions, you know?
Absolutely. And in the end, it's about letting the Bible challenge us, change us, and bring us closer to God.
That's a great point. But before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about something Vannoy mentions, but he doesn't really go into too much detail.
Oh, I'm curious. What is it?
Well, he talks about how prophets challenge that idea of opiparum, that rituals are effective just because you do them, regardless of your inner state. He emphasizes how important genuine devotion is. Heartfelt obedience.
Right. True worship comes from a heart that's been changed by God's love.
Exactly. But it makes me wonder, then, what is the role of rituals? If they're not some magic formula, if they don't automatically earn God's favor, then why do we do them? What's the point?
That is a great question. A question that deserves its own deep dive, I'd say.
For sure. But I think it's something for our listeners to think about as they continue to explore their own faith and spirituality.
It is. It really makes you think, how do the rituals we practice, whether they're religious rituals or even just things we do in our personal lives, how do they shape our understanding of God and our relationship with Him?
Yeah, it's a question that challenges us to look deeper, to examine our motivations, to seek that real connection with God.
And that, I think, is really what it means to be a true seeker, to be a deep diver into the mysteries of faith and life.
Man, this is really making me think. I'm walking away from this with a lot to chew on.
Yeah, it's one of those things you keep coming back to.
So for everyone listening, let's sum up what we've learned from Vannoy. What are the big takeaways about prophets and rituals?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that prophets weren't just, like, against rituals, period. It was more complicated than that. They were worried about the heart behind it all.
Right, not just going through the motions. They wanted a real connection with God.
Exactly. Remember that opus operatum thing, the idea that the ritual works just because you did it, no matter what you're feeling inside? The prophets hated that kind of empty religion.
They wanted that covenantal unity, right? Like Vannoy said, inner devotion matching the outward actions.
Yeah. And that's something we can think about today, too. Like, in our own lives, our own spiritual practices, are we just going through the motions, or are we really connecting?
It's a good question. I know I've been guilty of that sometimes, just going through the motions. But this lecture has really made me think about how I can bring more heart to my faith.
That's the power of these ancient texts, right? They still speak to us today. They challenge us, help us grow.
Totally. And I think that's a great place to wrap things up. We've explored how prophets and rituals relate. We tackled those tricky questions about authorship and hopefully got everyone thinking a little deeper.
It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and we'll see you next time.